New Year, same extra value meals at McDonald's. Now get a savory sausage McMuffin with egg, plus hash browns, and a small coffee for just $5.
For a limited time only, prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Governor Tryon. Happy birthday to you.
Now, can you tell I wasn't wearing underwear? Because apparently she wasn't.
This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own.
Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat.
Welcome to episode 315 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer. And we're in love with all things Outlander.
Did you almost forget?
No, I was trying to do something different. I know my name.
Oh, well, you did.
And I know my line.
Obviously, you said that.
And I was trying to be a little different because we never do that. We have a very set static pattern. I was trying to be different. Did that fail for you? Did that not work for you? Were you concerned? Okay, seaweed. I'm going to need you to stop.
I'm sorry,
listener. Nasty. Hear that now. That noise now, and all I'm thinking is like you're crunching poop-flavored nonsense in your mouth.
Nonsense. Sorry, dear listener, if that wasn't annoying at all. I did it on purpose. I wasn't going to have anything on the mic after we started recording. Just before I hit record, I was chomping. I was eating some Kirkland organic roasted seaweed
doesn't
snack.
Matter. Oh, doesn't matter who made it. It's all nasty.
I'm just reading the label.
I don't know anyone who's been able to make it that wasn't nasty.
Anyway, I was chomping on it and someone's like, oh, what's that crispy, whatever that the noise you're making.
I was hoping you were going to say Doritos, but you didn't.
Talk about a letdown.
Seriously. I was hoping it was going to be something fun.
I wonder if she's doing I wonder if it's nacho cheese Doritos, like the original.
It could have been something amazing.
Chili lime, which is kind of or Cool Ranch. Do they even make Cool Ranch anymore?
They sure do. It's one of their more popular flavors.
See, it shows you how much I know because I don't go out and buy them enough. Anyway, so you should open with that. Ginger, that was the biggest letdown ever. I thought you were cringing on something delicious.
No, it's
and
not.
And then I told her what it was and she went,
gross.
Or as that sound that they say cats make, like when they're about to vomit or whatever, like,
oh, nope. The noise that'll wake you up in the middle of the night.
Yes.
From a dead sleep. You hear nothing. You couldn't hear somebody breaking into your house, but you will 100% hear a cat trying to vomit on anywhere in your house.
100%. Yes.
So this is kind of a non sequitur announcement because it's not really an announcement, but it's just an announcement for me because it was such a weird thing that happened to me today. So it's topical. I received an email that said, hey, Summer, your artwork was up for review. An Outlander store thought it was pretty sweet. Sony has officially said they don't care about us selling it. So if you're interested in purchasing something with the painting that inspired our logo, it is available on redbubble.com. And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are continuing our The Fiery Cross read-along. We just finished part 5. We are beginning part 6, The War of the Regulation. We will start this week's read along with chapter 56 entitled, sit still, this is going to be long, entitled, And Fight Them, Saying They Had Men Enough to Kill Them, We Can Kill Them.
This chapter is entirely composed of the deposition of Wait Still Avery, a witness of something, and a communication between Governor Tryon and General Thomas Gage. Deposition. Basically, Wait Still Avery testifies that he saw 30 to 40 regulators. He was arrested by one of them, taken to a place where there were others. He learned the names of some of their captains, heard some of them say negative things about the governor and others. One of the dudes in the crowd really spoke badly about the king and lawyers and clerks and made threats. People talked about marching into Salisbury to fight. And then a letter, the gist of the letter was, there's a plan to raise a militia to march into settlements who are uprising. Requests or of assistance in getting weapons were made. And this is from, I believe, the governor. It included when he planned to march and how many men he plans to march. And that was 1,500 men.
I feel bad for you guys because I legit don't have a lot to say on these very exponential. Like, they're just laying facts out. Like, the letter chapters, I'm like, cool. Like, it's hard to comment on
facts.
Yeah. All right.
Not even facts. Just basics like, he did this and there were two people there.
Well, and it's not a conversation. It's a monologue. So it's not even like there's dialogue that included other people. It's just is what it is. Anywho, moving on to chapter 57 entitled, Now I Lay Me Down to Sleep.
Fraser's Ridge, April 15th, 1771. Roger is tired, yo. After spending 2 days riding all over hill and dale to spread the word about the upcoming militia march, now that they have a date. So they'd gotten the spring planting done in time, thank goodness, and there he had helped with tons of fixes and prep that had to be done around their property or the property in general. Claire's garden, we get an update on. It's pretty and blooming and birdies and buggies and it's a brewing. And biology's working. Nature's working. And Roger is digging. He's, like I said, he's doing a lot of things and helping out. And he's in bed, but he's not being able to sleep. And there's a whole thing about there's like mosquitoes and he's trying to sleep, but it's hard for him and all this.
There's a lot going on in this chapter with nothing happening. Like, there's a
lot. Well, that's why I tried to leave out a lot of the stuff about mosquitoes and just say, okay, this is a condition. They were able to do these things. He's doing this. And so he's in bed when the chapter starts and he's remembering all the stuff that they've been doing the last few days. Before he goes to sleep or before he tries to go to sleep again, he says goodnight to the Reverend and to his father and he blesses them. And then he goes on to include Mrs. Graham, Fiona, Ernie, her husband, Jemmy, and finally Bree. And he wonders what Bree is dreaming of just now.
No, he says she better not be dreaming about this.
What was this?
Remember her dream journal where she was talking about having an illicit sexual encounter with Roger? And he's like, well, she better not be dreaming about that since I just gave it to her real good. You don't remember that? How do you not remember that?
I remember the dream journal. I don't remember him. And I remember him saying something like, she better not be dreaming that. But I didn't know that he wouldn't want her to dream about him banging her when they are banging each other.
Okay. She says, what was she dreaming now? He wondered. He could feel the faint warmth on her breath of her breath on his face. Last night, I dreamed I made love with Roger. The memory of that particular entry still rankled. Hard as he tried to dismiss it, had it been drifting towards sleep, lulled by his litany, but the memory of her dream book pulled him back to wakefulness. She had damned well better not be dreaming of such a thing now, not after the time he'd just given her. That was an and I quote.
She, Bree, and Jem, the plan is for them to leave the next day and they'd be riding to Hillsborough, where she had been commissioned to paint a portrait. And at this point, he's remembering a rough sesh.
Tell me.
That's all I wrote.
You're not going to tell me more than that.
Yes.
What do you think it was?
Summer, that's not my job. That's your job. Okay. Let's be real. The men had been gathering all day. The men for this militia that Jamie has been tasked to muster. There were horses and muskets and everything. It's like the ridge is a crowded place right now. Now, Roger sees and overhears a scene between Jamie and Claire. They were getting ready to come in for the night. It was very sweet. And they were going to bed or going to bed soon, but Claire stayed out for a little bit. And Jamie went in and he's basically like, don't take too long. And she's like, don't go to bed yet. Stay ready for me. I mean, it's a lot. It's cute. And before finally going back to bed, he tells Jem good night. And he says, God bless you and keep you. Now, one of the things we're going to see over, at least in these chapters that we have in this episode this evening to discuss, is there's a lot of, understandably, because there's, you know, potential fighting and potential battles coming up. So, you know, there's potential for loss of life. That's always scary, or at least injury. It's always a possibility, especially back in the day. Well, no, who am I kidding? It's a possibility today as well. So it makes perfect sense that with this, number one, his wife and child are about to leave and hopefully, you know, be away, far away from the battle and be in safety, far enough away to be safe. And he's going in with his in-laws and he's another man there, to technically part of the militia. And the night before he says goodbye to Bree, he is kind of beginning or re-beginning this, not a litany of saints, but he's going through all the people whom he's loved or whom he loves, those with him in body and those only with him in spirit. And so we kind of see that beginning with this chapter. And the I wouldn't say theme, maybe it is a theme, but the theme or the topic, the thread of either goodbyes, blessings, prayer, that kind of thing. It kind of starts here, maybe earlier, but I just noticed it. We're going to see that quite a bit in these chapters tonight.
I remember listening to this chapter because I listen to all the chapters. Thank you, Davina. And I was thinking to myself, there was a whole section where he was doing push-ups and counting push-ups. And I was like, they can't possibly include this. Because I was like, I mean, they could show him doing push-ups, but it was such a cerebral push-up moment that I was like, they're not going to take the time to actually describe this. And this whole scene, like if they even keep the dream journal in the series about him reading it and seeing that she's got, you know, sexy dreams about being roughly manhandled by Roger and experiencing female pleasure, and him being spurred on to provide her more male pleasure. You know what I mean? It's like, I don't feel like they're going to spend a ton of time on that, but they could, but I just can't figure out how that would be part of the importance of season 5, considering how much they're going to have to cut this down. But neither here nor there. Moving on to chapter 58, entitled Happy Birthday to You.
Now, I'm listening to another podcast right now, not at this moment, but like on my drives, called The Killing of Marilyn Monroe. So not when I read it, not when I took notes, not when I thought about it, but just now when you were about to say it, I'm like, please,
I almost
do
did
it.
I almost sang it. One,
you did
I
not.
Did almost sing it. I was not going to go, happy birthday. I was not going to Marilyn Monroe it to you, but I was considering singing it right now.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, Mr. President. Happy birthday to you.
Now, can you tell I wasn't wearing underwear? Because apparently she wasn't.
Oh, she had apparently all the bits. Yeah, she was sewn into the dress. She had all, there was nothing left of the imagination. I loved it. And that's going to be like in the bumper for the episode. Literally, it's going to be the top of the episode before the music, before the, what do you call the, not the trailer. The,
I don't know what you call it. I wasn't doing it for that purpose. I was being.
But the only thing, I'm not disappointed at all, but the only thing I was like, oh, I wish you would have said something. And I know Marilyn, I said Marilyn, but I wish you would have done something else like Outlander related instead of Mr. President. What would you have done? If you change it, what would you have done?
Happy birthday, Governor Tryon. Happy birthday to you.
Okay, that's gonna make that's on the cut. Oh, that's awesome! I can't wait. Oh my god.
You're welcome.
Thank you. May 1st, 1771, May Union Camp. Do we know what May 1st is, by the way? It's a few things.
May Day. May Day. May Day. It's also my friend's birthday.
It is also. Who's your friend?
Judy.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Jamie.
No, my friend Judy.
He's our friend, but it's also Jamie's birthday. That's why I thought you were saying it. It is Jamie's birthday. It is also Beltane. So they've traveled. So this is not the same day that Roger was trying to get back to sleep. Claire wakes up and they're at camp. There are several hundred men there. She's enjoying waking up and not have to do the prep for the breakfast. They had arrived at Rendezvous Point at Colonel Bryan's plantation. Tryon hadn't quite arrived yet. It is Jamie's birthday, as we said, and he's turning 50.
That's like Molly Shannon. He needs to do like splits and kicks and like arms straight up. I'm 50 and I can stretch, kick, and stretch. Or whatever it is. It might be kick, stretch, kick, but either way, I think it needs to happen. Come on, stars, make it happen. It's too late now because they finished filming today, you guys.
Too late now.
Damn it.
That was another semi-announcement. So Claire tells him about how she takes stock when she has a birthday, about, just thinking about different parts of her body, different things she can do.
Different things she judges other people about that she hopes that she's not also the same with, you know, like the letter she sent to her daughter before she went back in time and told her, I hope you don't get fat.
That's
almost verbatim.
Lorraine B. writes, to me, this chapter showcases the love and humor that Claire and Jamie have for each other. As Claire wakes up in a makeshift tent with a few insect friends and rejoices that breakfast will be ready and made by someone else by the time she gets up, we learn that she, quote, prefers a bed involving Jamie and bugs to one with neither.
I may have to disagree with that statement. I can look, I enjoy sleeping with my boyfriend as much as the next person. But if I have to choose between a bed without bugs, that includes my boyfriend, and a bed with bugs, that includes my boyfriend, I'm going to choose a bed that does not include bugs. Ever. I will gladly give up bedtime with my significant other to make sure there's no bugs. That's it. That's the tweet.
She notices Jamie taking stock of himself as she wishes him a happy birthday. I love the playfulness when Jamie says that he doesn't think anything will fall off by dinner. And Claire teases him by giving his member a quick tug.
Yonk. Oh, my God. Could you imagine if that fell off after she pulled on it?
Oh, stop it. She declares, not loose at all, unquote. With every new detailed description of Jamie's body, a calloused hand battered by work, a nail wound still showing pale pink, the freckle on his earlobe, the lower incisor pushing eagerly forward, reminds us of his past and further rounds out a mental picture of the man we've come to love. Jamie says that Governor Tryon will be able to get men to march, but getting them to fight is another matter. Rumors are flying all around that the regulators had 10,000 men.
They don't.
False. False news. False news, fake news. Herman's husband had been arrested. Another militia had killed its officers. Lots of cray-cray is being rumored about. And there's also a rumor that the regulators had taken Hillsborough. Now, don't forget, that's where Bree and Jem were. But it's a rumor that regulators had taken the town. So Jamie and Claire, they chat about living longer than their parents had even been alive. And that's kind of a come to JC moment for them. They're like, that's legit there. And another great line, quote, the world and each day in it is a gift, Mokree, no matter what tomorrow may be, unquote. And Lorraine B. closes us out with, after a bit of philosophical introspection, the chapter ends with the same Jamie, with some Jamie humor. As for taking stock, I have all my teeth, none of my parts are missing, and my cock still stands up by itself in the morning. It could be worse.
It absolutely could be, and that's why I'm going to end that statement. All right, y'all. We are moving on to chapter 59, another letter chapter. Chapter 59 entitled Military Engines.
Okay, this one is a bit, so I'll just be prepared. Joe B. writes, the title refers to an historical way of referring to weaponry, siege engines, trebuchet, and later cannons, coming from a derivation of ingenuous, and referring to something new and unexpected. And from that, we get engines and engineering to refer to how things work. The two perspectives of this chapter are both engineers. Tryon, in his skill and management of a disparate and at times unwilling army. And Brianna, with a degree from MIT. I read up a bit on Tryon, and his story is a common narrative for the son of landed gentry. A child out of wedlock, marry an heiress,
by a commission. In the British Army, it was possible to buy into being an officer with only basic, or in some cases, no military training, as is provided to Mr. Wickham at the end of Pride and Prejudice. Thus the army was the common choice of the second sons of rich families. For instance, the 18th century Randalls, older and not mentioned much, oldest brother Edward has the estate. Jonathan has an interesting army commission, and Alexander goes into the church. The fourth son was reduced to some profession, lawyer, doctor, or banking. So, and according to Wikipedia, although Tryon bought his initial rank, he seemed to proceed through them at his own merits. Although there was undoubtedly some politicking, as then and now, arriving with the governorship of North Carolina, where he proceeded to build a palace, as is the cause for some of the consternation in TV season 4, block the state assembly from meeting to discuss a reaction to the much hated and catalyzing Stamp Act in 1765, and greatly promoting the cause of the Anglican, that is, Protestant in U.S. parlance, the Episcopal, Church. Anti-Catholic sentiment and discrimination was high, as we have seen in the fictional hold Tryon has over Jamie, and it seems that the real Tryon, whilst enforcing the laws that's prevented Catholic ownership of law of land and public office, was equally dedicated in promoting and encouraging the buildup and influence of the Protestant Church. So, far from being the background threat to create a narrative around, although that's true, Tryon himself is a serious and a credible threat. He is wise enough to give Jamie his head, but with the rise of the militia and the maneuvers against the rebels, we see who still has some control of the reins. So thank you, Joe B., for all that crazy, interesting information. Love hearing about real-life characters, real-life people from the times and about the settings. So excerpts from the Journal of Expedition Against the Insurgents, and this journal is kept by Tryon. So what I did was, it's not a ton of info, but I, rather than, like, how do you really take notes of it? So I basically did the date and then the gist of what happened that day. Thursday, May 2nd, two detachments left New Bern with munitions. Tryon left New Bern on the 27th of April and arrived at Colonel Bryan's on May 1st. Friday, May 3rd, Tryon reviews detachments. Saturday, May 5th, everyone marched to Johnston Courthouse, 9 miles. Sunday, May 6th, everyone marched to Major Hunter's in Wake County, 13 miles. Monday, May 7th, the army halted. The governor reviewed another regiment. There was general discontent among the Wake regiment. They weren't all armed and they didn't all obey. So the governor ordered the army to surround the battalion and draft officers from it. They built the Wake company to 50 men with the help of the officers. And then he returned to camp. Wednesday, May 8th, men were left behind to help keep disaffected men from forming groups and joining the regulators. They arrested a well-known regulator and brought him to camp. Friday, May 10th, they worked on wagons and worked on the horses. And the prisoner, that regulator prisoner they had, escaped. Sunday, May 12th, they made an unexpected move geographically, and they surprised and defeated some of the regulators. But the regulators pushed back General Waddell, and 20 more joined the army. Monday, May 13th, a verbal message is delivered from Waddell to Tryon. They didn't trust it to be in writing and to be taken by anyone. Thursday evening on the 9th of May, 2,000 regulators had surrounded Waddell's camp and required him to retreat. He lost men to the regulators, and he definitely did not outnumber them. A council of war was held. They planned to join their troops with Waddell. The regulators were supposedly attack that night. The men prepped for it, but no alarm was given. Tuesday, May 14th, they remained at camp. No alarm was given. Wednesday, May 15th, they decided to march against the rebels early the next morning. The governor sent a letter offering terms. Then, the very last part of the chapter, Joe B. writes, contrasting the clinical notes of troops, press gangs, marches, and strategies is the dream book.
The space where there is little expectation of rationality and structures, but rather the place of colors and uncontrollable thoughts. Where Bree, the engineer, becomes free spirit and the unrestrained artist. Yet the unknown war enters the space too, as the swirling, noisy, metallic gray cloud envelops her. For Bree, and even Roger, is settled into some of the realities of 18th century, and in spite of the trials they have seen, this chapter begins their baptism into a greater reality of where in time they are. Once off the ridge and into the wide world, history becomes reality. The children of the hyped Cold War and the distant Vietnam War are about to meet the realities of 18th century war. Safe away in Hillsborough, the smoke hides what is feared and what is unknown.
Hey, Ginger, what's your fab?
Something that makes me feel fab is travel. I love it. Ooh. How about you? What's your fit?
My fit. Good question. My fit, obviously, I wish I was more athletic, but my fit is completely related to self-care, which is sometimes 100% about unwinding after a workday. So I'm going to say that my fit is all about watching Outlander on Starz streaming service. It requires nothing from me and just allows me to not have to be responsible for a couple of hours every day. What would you describe as your fun?
That's easy. My fun is also travel.
So travel to you is fab, fit, and fun.
Fit, if I'm traveling, I try to get a walk in.
Hashtag pot abroad. Anyway, so I'm not going to lie, this season's Fab Fit Fun Box has been one of my absolute favorites. And as an Outlander fan, it could very easily be one of yours. And Kat Denning was just on Ellen recently talking about Outlander's knitwear. And this month, I customized my FabFitFun box to include the marled beanie and arm warmer set created by Rebecca Minkoff. I definitely am feeling my inner Claire when I put them on.
Even though we can customize our boxes, it's still a treat because you choose between things or you like rank things, but you never know until you open it, right? And so some of my favorites, the faux fur blanket, it is the softest thing I own. And I love also the hot pink Bluetooth speaker I can use in the bathroom. Actually, it's a shower sprinkler, a waterproof Bluetooth speaker. You can put it in your shower and connect it obviously with your phone or your Alexa, whatever your thing, your subscription service of choice, or have an audiobook, rock out to music. Just be careful, don't slip. But yeah, loving those.
And speaking about customizations, once a season, you can visit their site and choose, like how I chose the beanie set and Ginger chose the faux fur blanket.
FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box with full-size beauty, fitness, fashion, and lifestyle products. You can use coupon code OUTLANDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com.
Now, this box retails for $49.99, but always has a value of over $200. So for $10 off your first box, go to fabfitfun.com and use coupon code OUTLANDER.
From the dream book, Bree has dreamt of and is living in a gray cloud. And she believes some of that from her dream carried over into her wake.
Sorry. When I was listening to this being read by Davina, I missed the part where she was like, from the dream book. I didn't hear that part. And all of a sudden it was just like, last night I fell asleep. And I was like, who is talking? And then when you just said from the dream book, I was like, oh, the only person with the dream book is Bree. And I was like, I didn't relate what was said to Bree at all because it sounded like Claire's voice from Davina. So until just now, I did not realize that that section of the chapter was Bree.
Bree, although she's writing in her dream book, the drab and the darkness and the gray, she believes has followed her into her waking life.
All right, moving on to chapter 60 entitled Council of War.
Jamie was part of the Council of War and he shared information with Claire. In general, the troops were happy to finally be almost to be close to engaging. They were looking forward to engage. He'd gotten Cornell alone long enough to ask about Bonnet. My dude.
Boo.
My dude. Jamie, my dude. So what he finds out is Cornell had not met Bonnet, but he'd heard talk. Quote, "It seems he works," meaning Bonnet, right? "It seems he works his way up and down the Outer Banks for a bit and then disappears for 3 or 4 months. And then suddenly, one day he'll be there again, drinking in the taverns in Edenton and Roanoke, gold pieces spilling from his pockets," unquote. Yes, that's likely from dealing with or dealing in contraband. He also, this is quite entertaining, brings stuff, I guess items, contraband, ashore at Wiley's Landing. They don't know if Wiley is involved, but apparently Bonnet does bring stuff ashore next to or right onto near Wiley's property. But Bonnet has been gone the last few weeks. Also, Herman Husband is there with the regulators. Claire thought his presence was a hopeful sign that the regulators might not fight. Jamie communicated something to Roger, who then left. And what we find out is that he had told Roger to go to Herman Husband in the morning, find him, and bring him to them if possible, to chat with Tryon. He thinks that if Herman Husband thinks fighting means bloodshed, that he might be able to convince the regulators to stand down.
This was another confusing chapter for me, because there was a moment in the description where it sounded like Jamie was going to be taking the white flag of whatever and heading across the river or wherever he was going. And then I was like, oh, okay. And then when it came down to it was Roger heading over. So I had moments of like, wait, what? And I can't exactly explain why that was, but it was strange. So I don't know if it was because Jamie was describing Tryon telling him what needed to happen, and then that being disseminated to Roger, who was actually doing it. But it was a weird description via Davina for me to understand what was happening until Roger was actually talking to Herman Husband.
And Claire, as the sun is setting, and Claire points out the sky to Jamie. And he shares with her that at dawn and twilight, he thinks of his people, meaning his friends, his family, his acquaintances, everything, people who are important to him. He thinks of his people and he thinks of his Scotland, specifically and especially at those times of day. And she shares that although she had, you know, wasn't thinking of Scotland necessarily, she does share that she also thinks of her people at those times of days, at those times of day as well.
And moving on to chapter 61, entitled Ultimatums.
Great Alamance Camp, May 16th, 1771. So this chapter begins with or includes a letter in no uncertain terms. It communicated, lay down your arms, give up your leaders and submit to the crown. All this or there will be blood. Claire is now up and awake and drinking tea.
How do you spell that?
She gathers water. You can Google
it. No, blurred. How do you spell that?
I don't know how to spell it.
You said it. How could you say it out loud if you don't know how to spell it? That's unfortunate because you write down everything you say.
Not everything.
Most of the things. So how did you not write that word down?
I just said I wrote blood and then I just elongated it. Claire is up and drinking tea. She gathers water to boil or goes to gather water to boil in case of war and wounds, you know, her doctory kind of thing. Jamie had gone to another council of war and returned, looking, unfortunately, spick and span, dressed for battle. Crazy straight laced.
Blurred.
But they have to wait and see. Roger had gone, as asked. Tryon arrives, but he arrives to chat with Jamie, but Claire's like, I'm going nowhere. Jamie's troops are ready, and to check and see if the governor's horse is ready, Jamie lets out a Highland cry and the horse like jerks and basically disposes of the governor to the ground. Militiamen come out of the thickets. Like, they're bringing their guns. Like, crows explode out of trees. It's like, what the huh? What happened? And then the horse bolted. Yeah, that wasn't really nice of Jamie, because he probably knew, like, there's a 99% chance that that was going to happen. And Claire's like, I best not look at him because my face. She like turns around and pretends to be interested in something else. Poor Claire. Oh, I think I would have burst a gasket or something. So in total, they have 1,068 militiamen. They've got cannons, and they will have more men once they join Waddell. Now, Tryon thinks that Herman's husband is the leader of the regulators, meaning like that. You could make a case for instigator, but he's the leader and instigator and rabble rouser, the main one of the regulators. Jamie is trying very, very hard to change his opinion. He tells him that he sent Roger to get Herman's husband, and he begs him that if Herman's husband does come, please listen to him. Tryon, yada, 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 yada. He says basically, no, that time has passed. But the governor says if he comes and if he agrees to convince his men to lay down arms, then he will speak to him. But he's like, I'm not waiting on that. Now, how long did they have? Roger had been gone for 2 hours. Tryon says to stand ready. Basically is telling the men to get ready. So how long do they have? Not long.
All right. And we are rounding up tonight's read along, finishing the hour, the Fiery Cross read along for the evening with chapter 62 entitled Stragglers and Suspected Persons.
Susanna M. writes, the title seems like an off-page quote from the camp duties and regulation orders of Governor Tryon that are mentioned more than once in this chapter. Of course, Roger is in danger of being considered a straggler or suspected person by both sides, and that could get him into big trouble. From the governor's camp duties and regulations, no officer or soldier should leave camp. All stragglers and suspected persons should be confined and reported to headquarters. Roger's on the loose. He has a militia badge, quote, an inch and a half wide button of metal pierced around the edges, stamped with the crude FC for Fraser's company and meant to be sewn onto a coat or hat, unquote. Yeah, he didn't do that. Roger asks how he's supposed to know who to shoot. He's talking to Jamie. If the badges are so small, what good are they? Now, privately, he'd resolve not to fire at anyone. Roger's thinking like a historian. Well, he knows what happened, right? But he's also thinking like a historian. He sees it as history, but also knowing more history than Herman's husband and the regulators, he has a hard time demonizing people who legitimately protest against abuses and corruption. So Roger's walking, trying to find the regulators. Now, before he gets there, he sees or hears the conversation of some foragers. Now, these foragers were part of the militia, actually, but they were out doing some hunting or foraging. But he overheard them saying that the regulators outnumber the militia 2-1. Now, Roger still has not put his badge on. Roger is taking a big chance, right? Quite frankly, even with his little badge, it wouldn't have helped him at a long distance. But he believes that if he were challenged, he doesn't think that anyone would shoot him in the back without at least giving a shout of warning. So that's why he's not really, you know, too keen on putting this badge on.
I mean, they're not at the point where uniforms are a thing. So
Correct. On
site, you don't look like
no.
the enemy, right?
Mm-hmm. And he was also, on purpose, unarmed. I mean, he had a knife with him, but nothing he could hurt someone out from a distance, someone with from a distance. Jamie had told him that if he felt he were threatened, to wave his white kerchief and cry truce And this kind of made him kind of have a little giggle at the picture in his mind. Susanna M. writes, "This conversation is a sad..." Oh, girl, careful. "This conversation is a sad foreshadowing of what is to come. Roger is a militia man that goes into regulator territory, not knowing who is friend or enemy. They don't know him as well, and behind enemy... They don't know him as well, and behind enemy lines, anything can happen. Roger doesn't have a badge. I mean, he has it, but he's not using it. But he has a truce flag. Will that help him?" Huh. Eric B. writes, "I love that while on his mission..." Oh, sorry, sorry. So as Roger is walking closer and closer, trying to find them, the regulator camp, he has a feeling of a sense of someone who is with him. And he says, "That you, Dad?" Erica B. writes, "I love that while on his mission to get husband, Roger feels he might be in the company of his father's spirit, perhaps guiding and protecting him while he navigates this tricky time period." So Roger's walking off. He's like, okay, he comes across, there's a creek. He's across the creek. He takes his shoes and stockings off to cross the creek. And while he was putting them back on later, he hears voices. It was a woman's voice and then men's voices. And he believed it was three men and two women. He walks away wondering where in the heck everyone is. Like, I am supposed to be coming up on a camp of more people than we have. I'm not seeing anything. And then he stumbles upon some women washing laundry in the creek. And some men ran by and he asks for Herman Husband. And they basically share that, oh, he's out that way. You know, they weren't really interested. They knew of him kind of, but they weren't really that helpful. But the further Roger walks, the more he senses that the general sense of the men is changing. And as it gets maybe tighter, more firm, more intense, more intense is probably the best word, he finds Herman Husband. Eric B. continues, "A few beats later, we learn it's a few regulators with some whores." Those are the women and men he came across before, the washerwomen or the women washing. Some men who wanting to get lucky with some whores in some nearby bushes. Pun not intended. And Roger sneaks away unnoticed and probably snickering. I know I would be. So Roger, Herman Husband was arguing with the other regulators. He is saying there is always a choice in fighting. The men are yelling back, "No, our choice is gone. Tryon has took all of our choice away." Has taken all of our choice away.
I mean, it's not he crow. Yells, depends on what you thought your choices should be.
Oh, well, you always have a choice.
If it's not an acceptable choice to go home and not fight people, then yeah, he took all your choices away.
But they still have a choice of staying or not staying, or let alone fighting or not fighting.
But the only option to fighting is go home and don't fight. So unless if that's an acceptable option for you, then cool. You were given an awesome choice. If going home and not fighting is not an option, you were not given any choice by Tryon. That was my point.
Yes, but that's what Roger is trying to remind them, if he can get in a word in, is that, yeah, I guess there are three choices, right? There's scatter, everyone go home, which is what Husband is trying to urge them to do, or will shortly. There's fighting, which is let's go fight and kill people. And then there's what Roger's trying to do. Yeah, Roger would like them all to leave. But there's what Roger's trying to do, which is, Herman Husband, come with us. You might be able to, you know, talk to, well, at least it's Roger's intent. You might be able to not convince the governor, but talk to him and then come back and be able to relay, you know, to share with these people that y'all, outnumbered or no, they got guns, they got munitions. Like, there's no winning that. There's no beating that. And Herman Husband, again, for all his intensity, is not. He's a Quaker, right? He's a pacifist. He does not want bloodshed. So he is trying to tell the regulators that there's always a choice in fighting, even if you feel you have been pushed or whatever into this certain thing, it is always your choice. If you're right in front of someone with a gun and they're about to shoot you, then obviously most people are going to shoot back or try to save themselves. That's not what he's saying. He's saying right now we still have a choice. You can go home. You can go forward, or you can. Huh?
When you're dead, you no longer have a choice. You're dead.
Well, they're not dead.
No, they're not dead. But that's the option. You can guaranteed walk away from this.
Yes.
Or you can potentially die. And that's what staying is. You either leave and go home and live to see another day for sure. Maybe. Or you stay and then you run the risk of not surviving another day. And that was not anything that Herman Husband was prepared to be a part of. He's no, guys. And he had this great scene.
Yes.
One-on-one with Roger in that building or cabin.
We're getting there.
Okay, fine.
Like, girl, don't take my thunder.
All I want to do is take your thunder. It's the only thing I want.
So Roger's there. He sees him talking or yelling or chatting, whatever, with the dudes. And he yells in order to get their attention. He yells that he must speak with Herman Husband. He is able to extricate him from the group. And they walk away to a cabin, someone's cabin there. And he locks them inside. He pulls the bar down on the door. He shares with Husband what Jamie had shared. He asks, would Herman Husband help him go with him back to see Jamie Fraser? Would he call a truce and go with him to see Jamie Fraser? Herman Husband also says that, also, it's very funny. And I, like, how helpful is this? I don't even know. I took the notes and I didn't.
If I, like, don't laugh,
this didn't.
You're not allowed to call this funny. Go ahead. Tell me.
Oh, stop it.
Very ironic.
Not haha funny, but like silly funny. Maybe. So it's funny that even though I took the notes hours ago, it didn't hit me that I wrote this language, that he said these words, or that he had like the same thing. Herman Husband is also saying the same as Tryon. The time for speaking is gone. And that did not hit me until I just read it. So Roger basically tells Herman Husband all the information. He's like, he's committing treason right now. He's telling him where they are, how many they are, what they have, what their plans are. Like, he's given up the goods for a good purpose, right? He's trying to save lives. He's doing his best to save lives. He says the regulators have no true leader. Would Herman Husband speak for them and speak to them? Herman Husband is like, it's rough right now. And then he asks Roger to pray with him. Now, men are shouting from outside. Someone says that the governor has given them an hour only. So in their time together in prayer, it's as if time stands still. And the prayer that Roger remembers, because Herman was kind of like, it was a much more meaningful moment. But I had the, even though Roger didn't speak, Herman's like, I know you're a papist, but please, we don't pray out loud. We don't pray aloud. So I want you to pray with me,
quietly,
but don't talk.
But I feel
exactly.
I feel like,
but please,
that's a conversation I have with you all the time. I like you to hang out with me, but don't talk. It doesn't always work. In fact, it never works, but the intention is always there.
So the prayer that Roger remembers from the Reverend is, quote, help us, O Lord, to remember how often men do wrong through want of thought rather than from lack of love, and how cunning are the snares that trip our feet. Eek. I'm telling y'all, like, prayer and life and I didn't say life and death, but prayer and feeling or sensing those whom you've lost around you. So Roger did that as he was walking, right? And he thought he felt the presence of his dad. And Jamie and Claire at sunrise and sunset, both remember people they love, people that they've lost. And Jamie remembers places and he thinks of Scotland, right? So you have not just prayer and thoughts of, and before Roger left the ridge, right? He was saying, God bless you, be well. God bless you, be well. To, like, he was doing his own mini litany of saints. He was saying, God bless you, be well, God be with you, that kind of thing. And saying, not saying goodbye, but almost like a leave taking, because as I said, there's a chance when you're going to war, you're not coming back. So he's it kind of, you know, it's very sobering. And so starting with the first chapter in this little section that we're doing for this episode, you see a lot of, whether it's prayer or remembering or blessing, there's a lot of that in almost all of these chapters, except the ones with all the communiques. So just before their prayer together, their time ends, he is having like not an out-of-body experience, but he's so close to Herman. Like he sees like the little tiny flecks in his eyes. He's so close to Herman's husband.
She was real descriptive about his eyes. They were like gray.
They're gray and they have blue specks.
Like designs. And let me see if we can find it. Hang on. Because it was very specific. To the point that I was like, oh, I have never seen eyes like that. He said, soft gray eyes, flecks of blue in them, and tiny splinters of black. So trying to imagine, I don't think I've ever consciously seen anyone with light eyes that had like splinters of black in them.
Me either. So just as their prayer is ending or has ended, he's in such a state in this mm-hmm. I guess prayerful state that he's looking at Herman husband, he sees him and the way it, and part of the description, Diana's description of his eyes, right? His irises, part of that description is part of what I'm trying to now convey is he sees him. He almost doesn't have an out of body experience, but he has like, he's seeing him not as just someone who's, you know, sitting there in front of him. He's seeing them as, quote, a heartbreaking singularity, a thing unique and wonderful, irreplaceable. So he compared it to how he saw his own son when he would sit there and admire and say, oh my gosh, these fingers, they're just, these are incredible things, or his little toes or his little nose or whatever. He's seeing him. And what I thought that she was implying is that he was seeing someone, a being who is beautiful, heartbreakingly beautiful and so beautifully made and irreplaceable and unique. He was seeing husband as he saw Jem, as God might see his creatures. And I thought that's beautiful, beautiful Diana. Eric B. writes, Roger has a moment with husband where husband asks Roger to pray with him, to guide him and the mob with wisdom, offering comfort in a time of trial for husband. It feels like a hint of what might come in the future, and he recites the prayer the Reverend would say as it flowed naturally in his thoughts. Susanna M. writes, at first, I could not believe that in the middle of this almost war, Roger and Herman's husband would take time to pray. And that epiphany they had, I really wasn't able to understand it. Maybe it helped ease their minds or give them peace, but it did not help the situation at all. Herman's husband thanks him and gets up and prepares to go. He opens the door and tells the crowd, quote, go home. We must leave this
He's
place.
Like, each cool. I'm out. However,
we're done.
Roger, as the messenger, I'm gonna leave you here to, you know, be punished as the messenger. Like he was like, peace out, and he was just gone. And then all of a sudden, Roger's being picked on by everyone who's left, going like, what? What do you mean, Herman husband? We can't just end this. We don't have places to go back to. This is all we have right now. And Roger's left there holding like this, whatever. He's standing there as the symbol of the person who has ruined your foreseeable future. And I'm just going to leave him here to take the brunt of whatever your discontent is.
Yeah, it's a really, I don't want to say strange. I mean, it's not unstrange, but it's a really like,
it is. And I'm also, choice. I am constantly reminded of how little Roger is in possession of even the smallest amount of self-preservation. Like, he has none.
Good grief.
He's so reactive from moment to moment that he's never thinking further than the moment he's a part of. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like he's constantly reactive, just reacting, so that he doesn't ever have time to have any kind of a plan in place to keep him from being damaged and or injured and or attempted to be damaged and or injured.
As I say, a special biscuit.
I like biscuits. My biscuits don't don't put themselves up to get their asses handed to them very often.
Oh, that's funny. Yeah. So as Summer said, Herman husband says, peace out and rides away. And someone, and then they're like,
"Who are
wait,
you?
What,
and
wait,
what did you tell him?"
And they look over and they see exactly, who are you? We're going to kill you, but not before you tell us what happened. No, he tells them that he was there to tell Roger. Roger tells them that he was there to tell the rest of them, including husband, that the governor wanted to avoid bloodshed, but the people were not having it. He repeats the condition of the militia of the governor. The men taunt that they have twice the number of men as the militia. In the end, they tell him to go back to the governor. They tell him that we mean to have our way. Erica B. writes, the regulators are just so angry, they refuse to listen to the advice of go home. I just can't read that without laughing. While reading this section, I was hoping Roger would walk away unscathed from this mob, and I wasn't hopeful after they had pretty much cornered him. Like husband, Roger really did try and get them to heed their warning, but they seemed unfazed. None of it was working out for them. Once they found out Roger had connections with the enemy, they started to get violent with him, and I got worried. Thankfully, nothing bad happened. Susanna M. writes, having had a spoiler about Roger's visit to the other side, I believed the men left behind when husband departed would have acted violently toward him because he had obviously come from the other side. I was very relieved when they allowed him to leave unharmed. Was he protected by his prayer? So basically, after this point, they let him go. Roger turns and walks away with the words of the Reverend in his ears.
And he hoped one got credit for trying. All right, y'all. That concludes this week's The Fiery Cross Read-Along.
Super duper.
Join us next time. Not next week. Next week is Thanksgiving, y'all. We will be back after Thanksgiving. But join us next time when we will be continuing our The Fiery Cross Read-Along. And we will be discussing a bunch of chapters, y'all. 63 through 71. And those chapters are 63, The Surgeon's Book 1. 64, Signal for Action. 65, Almance. 66, A Necessary Sacrifice. 67, Aftermath. 68, Execution of Orders. 69, Hideous Emergency. 70, All is Well. And 71, A Feeble Spark. And as always, if you'd like to continue the conversation, please join us on our Facebook page at www.outlanderpod.com/group.
Yes, absolutely. That's the right link. And that would not be our page. It would be our group. But yes, please join us. And we want to say thank you so much to our supporters on Patreon. And if you love our content that was created just for you, fellow Outlander fan, please consider joining our other supporters on Patreon. And you can find out all the information at patreon.com/outlanderpod. Or if you have any questions, you can always email us, tweet us, message us, any of the places where we're at. We're always happy to chat about what it is and what it means, etc. So thank you as always so much for listening. Have a very happy Thanksgiving, and we will see you or hear you, or no, you will hear us after the holidays. Wait a second. That means December. We'll be back in December, Summer. Holy mid doodles.
That's right.
So thank you guys so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode.
Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at outlanderpod.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, like, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.